hppodcraft.com.
The expedition with which Raoul Briggs found himself connected was made up of artists, savants, and several men, capitalists, who represented the business interests of the venture. Before the white cliffs of the English coast were entirely lost to view, Raoul's natural propensities for leadership were being fully recognized by the students about him. There was an immediate demand for his professional services, and he was kept busy for many days. And it was the best panacea for a nature like his, deep and silent and self-suppressing. He had abandoned happiness for duty. He had stifled all those ominous voices which rose from the depth of his heart and said to him, "Will you ever return? And if you return, will you find your dear one? And if you find her, will she not have changed? Will she have preserved your memory as faithfully as you will preserve hers?"
His heart also asks why he can't stop thinking about Tony, wondering where he could be, who he's with, what is he thinking? Is he thinking of him, and will he ever return someday?
What are you talking about?
That reference is a deep cut, dude. Kids in the Hall, Hotel A Rut.
Oh, yes, I've seen that, but I couldn't... It sounded familiar, but I didn't get the reference.
Would you just stop thinking about Tony, wondering where he could be, who he's with, what is he thinking? Is he thinking of you, and will he ever return someday?
That reminds me, I used to want to do an act where I was like an observational comedian like Seinfeld.
Yeah.
You know, how he's like, "You ever notice how we drive on parkways, but park in driveways," kind of thing?
Yeah.
Except I wouldn't understand that the observation has to be something that everybody understands for the comedy to work. So the whole routine would be like, "You ever notice how tired my dad looks?" Like, "Hey, I went down to one of those newfangled movie theaters. It was crowded, but, you know, you ever notice how drunk I get when I'm uncomfortable?" Know what I'm saying?
Oh, golly. But we're not here to talk about comedy.
No.
We are here to talk about Of One Blood, a novel by Pauline Hopkins. This is a book H.P. Lovecraft had never read and probably would never have ever read.
Yes.
But we're still going to cover it on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Here at hppodcraft.com, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
And I don't know if Lovecraft would have read it or not. It's hard to make that judgment. I knew that he had racial prejudice, but he might have read something by anybody.
Possibly.
Especially this, because it has ghosts, has reanimations,
yep,
hidden family histories, lost civilizations, pretty much everything that we talk about here on the show.
And who was that delightful reader that we had?
Well, our reader is once again KJ Middlebrooks.
I thought I recognized him.
Yes, he's back again, and I believe he'll finish the story up with us. KJ's a great guy. He's my favorite Dracula. Portrayed Dracula in a little play that I wrote. And I'll link out to his Facebook fan page and Instagram, so folks, please go hit that up. Real quick summary where we are to this point. Raoul Briggs is a young medical student interested in mysticism who falls in love with a woman named Dianthe. He saw visions of her, he saw her perform with black musicians, and knows that she's black, although she passes as white. She was in a train accident, which made her seem dead, but he brought her back to life because he knows some special stuff. She has no memory, so she goes under an assumed identity. Raoul marries her, but he's broke, so goes to his friend Aubrey Livingston. Aubrey's supposed to be his best buddy. He helps him out by offering to obtain for him a place in an expedition about to explore the ancient city of Meroe in Africa. Raoul accepts, but after his departure, Dianthe finds that Livingston is in love with her, and he acquires a power over her that she cannot resist, somehow. She agrees to fly with him against her will. How could she agree if it's against her will? I'm reading the summary that's in the Colored American magazine.
Right.
But before the time is set, they, with Molly Vance, go out canoeing, and they're overturned in the river. All three are supposed to have been drowned. That's where we left you off last time. In this episode, we're going to catch up with Raoul in Africa.
Now, this ancient city they want to explore, Meroe, is an actual place.
Yes.
It's in modern-day Sudan.
It's also mentioned in The Cats of Ulthar, if you remember that.
I didn't remember
that. The cat is cryptic and close to strange things which men cannot see. He is the soul of antique Egyptus and bearer of tales from forgotten cities in Meroe and Ophir. So, a place Lovecraft has written about.
Meroe was once the capital of the Kushan Empire, which at one point ruled Egypt as the 25th dynasty in the 8th century BC. They had pyramids as well, but they were smaller and very pointy, tall, but with a smaller base. The characters are going to go to these ruins to hopefully find some lost knowledge about another place that has yet to be discovered.
Yes.
But our hero, Raoul, is feeling like he might have made a mistake. But he's here, so he's going to do his job, and he has his good buddy Charlie Vance with him on the expedition. Life ain't so bad.
They get to Tripoli. It's this beautiful ancient city. There was a description here which I found interesting. It says that a few cable lengths away, the city smiles at them with all the fascination of a modern Cleopatra, circled with an oasis of palms studded with hundreds of domes and minarets. Against a sky of amethyst, the city stands forth with a penetrating charm. It is the eternal enchantment of the cities of the Orient seen at a distance. But alas, set foot within them, The illusion vanishes and disgust seizes you. Like beautiful bodies, they have the appearance of life, but within the worm of decay and death, eats ceaselessly. The Orient would be referring to anything east of Europe at that time. That usually included this area of northern Africa. But I found that to be a really Dunsanian, Lovecraftian, Robert E. Howard kind of description of these old ancient cities when they get that first glimpse of Africa. Mm-hmm. Vance actually says, "It promises to be better than anything Barnum has ever given us, even at a dollar extra reserved seat." So he's super excited about exploring this ancient city.
Now, there's this other guy from home that came on the trip, this guy, Jim Titus. Mm-hmm. And he's an old black guy who was a former slave. And he has some kind of backward ideas about white folks being appointed by God to rule over black folks. And he's very submissive.
To Aubrey, in particular.
Yes.
Rule feels a little suspicious of him. And as we know, this was the fellow that Aubrey had written that letter to. Mm-hmm. Saying, have it done within 6 months, whatever that meant.
Yeah.
They get to shore. They're really flabbergasted by all the chaos of this African markets, the way that the people are acting. There was this phrase that said, that I thought was so cool in here, that she writes, "Most of them had acquired the necessary art of not hurrying, and under their direction, the examination of the baggage proceeded rapidly." And it's worth saying that this book, the writing in this book, is straightforward.
Yeah.
It's sometimes pulpy, sometimes seemingly influenced by the fact that this was serialized. Mm-hmm. There'll either be some irrelevant pieces of story that I think were just thrown in for column width, or some plot threads that never get picked up on again, kind of like that mesmerist that she was traveling with.
Right.
Never hear about that again.
No.
But sometimes there are really great allusions to poetry that reveal she has this deep level of education, the author.
Yeah.
But I also found little gems like that phrase I just read, too. About, you know, it kind of reminded me, there's that Charles Bukowski quote where he says, "An intellectual says a simple thing in a hard way. An artist says a hard thing in a simple way."
Oh, yeah.
And this was one of those moments, because they're having this tension, this idea that they acquired the necessary art of not hurrying, and because of that, things proceeded rapidly, is an interesting turn of phrase.
Yeah.
But it makes sense, because in these cultures, hurrying around, you know, that idea of American, like, we got to be doing something all the time, is not culturally as important. In order for things to go well, you have to be relaxed, because if you start hurrying people, it even goes slower. It's that kind of thing. And the tension in how slow things take is very important, because right when they get to Tripoli, they have to wait even more.
There's this guy, well, it's a sheik that's kind of in charge there, and he just kind of keeps them waiting. They're supposed to meet with him, and he's going to hook them up with the local stuff that they need, like the camels and the supplies and all those things. But this sheik just keeps them waiting, first for weeks and then months.
It says, "Raul had learned to be patient in the dolce far niente of the East, but not so for Charlie. Dolce far niente means the sweetness of doing nothing. It's a cultural value. People are just going to be chilling out, and when they show up, they'll show up." It's a very anti-American sentiment and hard for these guys to get used to.
Raul and Charlie, however, are the only ones not getting letters while they're in Tripoli.
At this point, even Jim is getting letters, but nothing for them, so they're very anxious about what's going on at home.
Finally, the sheik does show up, and he introduces this guy, Ababdis, and he's the guy with the camels and the local guy that will manage all the local logistics.
They're waiting to leave on the last day to see if any letters come. They don't, so they gotta split. Vance cracks jokes about ladies the whole time. Raul is enchanted by the songs of the locals. Those are distracting things, but they're both still very worried about what could possibly be happening at home.
As they travel on, they get through the desert and camp near a plateau, on top of which is this ruined castle. Mm-hmm. And Raul wants to check it out, but the Arabs tell him that it's dangerous and there are lions. Raul, he doesn't listen, and he takes Jim Titus up there to go with him and check it out one night. Raul leaves Titus by the entrance and then goes and looks around. The ruins are on the edge of the plateau, and he hears the sound, which he realizes is the Arabs singing. And so he's not paying attention, and leopard attack!
That's right.
Raul fortunately sees it before it's going to pounce on him, and he yells for Jim. And I mean, he yells for Jim, but nothing. And then he looks for a big rock to use as a weapon, but there's no rock to throw. And he's like, okay, I'm in trouble. But he's on this kind of cliff, this bit of the castle that goes over. And his plan is to sort of sidestep the leopard over the cliff. So when it pounces at him, he'll just kind of give it a push and it'll go over. Not a great plan, but it's the best he's got. And just in the nick of time, here's Charlie. Charlie shows up, throws him a gun, and he blasts the leopard dead.
Right.
When they find Jim, he's apparently sleeping.
Yeah, there's no way he was sleeping. Pretending to be asleep is like the original lie. But this part was clearly action for action's sake, I thought.
Yeah.
Just throwing a leopard in there. That's that column width thing I was talking about.
Yeah.
What's surprising to me is that this is a trick people will still use. If you've ever seen the first season of 24, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Second season.
Is it the second season?
It's the second season, yeah. The first season's pretty solid. The second season is when they're getting desperate for stuff. She gets menaced by a cougar.
Like, if things are slowing down in your story, throw in a great cat attack. And people are still doing it to this day.
I'm all for it. More great cat attacks. In the next chapter, they talk about the guy that's in charge of this whole operation, the one that had this idea, this guy, Professor Stone. Since Marowi was such a center of trade, his plan is to find records of trade where riches were heading in the ruins of Marowi. He believes that there was an advanced African black people. Raoul says such knowledge would turn the Western world on its ear if such a thing were true. And then the professor goes on to say that all of his research points to the fact that there was a primal race where we all come from, and it was black. Which is pretty much true. I mean, I did a little bit of research on this because I was curious. The first true humans were definitely dark-skinned, but as the transition from our hairy ancestors to our non-hairy ancestors, they were kind of lighter-skinned the more hair they had. But as the hair went away, their skin became darker. At least that's the dominant theory with anthropology that I could find in my 10 minutes of research.
But that's not what these folks are talking about.
No, they get a lot of their facts from the Bible.
There was this passage, because this is always astonishing to Charlie as they're talking about this ancient race, and that it was these Africans that built such great civilization. Raoul says, "Don't touch upon the origin of the Negro," to the professor. "You'll find yourself in a labyrinth. That question has provoked more discussion than any other concerning the different races of man on the globe. Speculation has exhausted itself, yet the mystery appears to remain unsolved." And I couldn't help but think, well, the poet H.P. Lovecraft has a notion about this. On the origin of the Negro. He wrote this terrible poem about it, which obviously we've never covered. But these weird ideas about there being different species of men on the earth, like our racial differences actually accounting for us being of some kind of different species, rather than a people of one blood, as this book maintains. I mean, these are discussions that would have been actually seriously being had around Lovecraft as an adolescent.
Sure.
And this book tells you what people were talking about at that time.
Yeah.
And those things would have definitely influenced his thoughts later on. The fact that they're saying it's this big mystery, where did the Negro come from? I mean, it's from where we all came from. But that's something that people had a hard time admitting.
Times have changed, thank God. That night, Raoul gets a vision of a black lady, Mira. It's the same one that Dianthe saw. And she gives him a vision of Titus reading a letter. And he could kind of somehow see through Titus's eyes and reads what the letter says.
Right.
And it says, "Use your discretion about the final act, but be sure the letters are destroyed. I had advised the letters sent in your care, as you will probably be detailed for the mail. But to avoid mishap, call for the mail for both parties. Address me at Laurel Hill, Thomas Johnson, signed A.L. Now, Raoul is freaked out by this. He thinks Titus wouldn't have never done such a thing. But then he starts to think about the lie of him sleeping.
Right.
And when the leopard was attacking, and he's like, wow, he was going to let the leopard kill me as part of some kind of task that he's been assigned.
Raoul's powers are really strange. He was just hanging out and suddenly had a vision of this treachery, completely detailed with a letter and everything.
Well, it was brought to him by Mira.
Brought to you by Mira.
So she, or her spirit or something about
this
woman, is like her ghost, or, you know, it's never really explained. It's very weird.
She is a supernatural helper.
After that happens, as he's going to sleep, he hears, "Raoul, Raoul, save me." And then he wakes up Charlie because they're sleeping in the same tent. And he goes, "Charlie, can you hear that?" And Charlie's like, "No, I don't hear it." And he goes, "No, but listen, I hear something." And then Charlie goes, "Whoa, I hear something else. I don't hear that. I hear Charlie, brother, save me."
Clearly some message is being sent to them. Their friends are in trouble.
You know, Raoul forgot that he has got this superpower. Charlie reminds him. He goes, "Oh, remember that cool superpower you have where you can see things that are far away?" And he goes, "Oh, right. I do remember that cool superpower. That would come in handy right now." He goes, "Okay, we'll do it." So he goes into a trance. He does some far-seeing, you know, remote viewing stuff.
"Ah, there is Molly. Poor Molly. And I see your father weeps. And the friends are there. And they too weep. But where is my own sweet girl, Dianthe? Love? Wife? No! I cannot see her. I do not find the poor maimed body of my love. And Aubrey? What? Traitor? False friend? I shall return for vengeance. Wake me, Charlie."
Comes out of the trance, explains to Charlie, "I suspect that Aubrey has done something terrible to your sister and to my wife." And so they lay their plans that if this is true, they're going to go on to Meroe and then see if any letters are there waiting for them to explain this away, possibly if it was an accident that
right.
this isn't really happening. And if not, if those letters aren't there, they're going to fly back to America. As I was thinking about the scene with this remote viewing stuff, I started looking at this book with another piece of literature in mind, which was Star Wars. And it was in this section here that really tripped that part of my brain, because his powers are they're kind of like force powers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
In that they don't really need to be explained. They can do whatever fits the situation.
Yeah.
But it's that, you know, my friends are in trouble and I sensed it. So I got to get home to take care of them, which is right at Empire Strikes Back.
Sure.
But there are other things. He's got these mystical powers. So does Dianthe. So does Aubrey, the villain.
Mm-hmm.
They all share something else that's critical between the hero, the love interest, and the villain in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Which is, we're going to find out later. I mean, it's okay if we're spoiling this now, right? I mean, there's blood between them. They're related. The whole thing, you know, Rule is called out of obscurity after revealing that he's got these talents. He goes out into this world fraught with danger where he discovers his origins, has to use his powers to confront it. It just really started making me think of Star Wars. And just a minute ago when he talked about Mira, she's completely the, you know, the blue outlined ghost.
Sure.
It's going to show up occasionally and explain things to these people. What did you see that at all, or did it occur to you?
Yeah, I know. Well, I know you're talking about specifics and you're right. They're really similar. But what makes, I think, Star Wars so powerful story-wise is the fact that it's family and that there's so much drama in family and relationships. The fact is, with your friends, you can ditch them, but with your family, you're connected forever.
Yes.
An animalistic, primal view, you are your family and your family is you, whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you could rebel against it and you could run away from it, but it still makes you who you are. Your genes and your early development, you've got no control over these things, yet they are fundamentally who you are.
Yeah.
That's heavy stuff.
It is.
You know, and in Star Wars, if you're Darth Vader's son, what does that say about you?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if you can save Darth Vader, you can save yourself.
Right, right. That's why, you know, this book fits in so well with all the discussions that we've been having, because that idea of bloodline, who you might be related to, what might be in your past is heavily laced in Lovecraft's work and a lot of the things that we do. So this is, it's excellent, but I never really related it to Star Wars like that.
No. There's some crazy parallels from this to Star Wars, and I don't remember Lucas ever giving this credit, so...
He should have.
The next chapter, one afternoon, 2 weeks after this happens, the caravan has stopped by a small Arab town, which forms the outpost to the island of Meroe.
Right. They have to row to get out there. And Charlie is really impressed by being in the ancient world. It's actually changing his character. He's becoming a little more dour and less playful. He's used to all the business of new cities that are always under construction, the hustle and bustle of America. But here in this ancient world, there's no future. There's no railroads, no churches, no saloons, no schoolhouses with the voices of merry children, right? Mm-hmm. There's only the monotony of past centuries, which are dead and forgotten. And it's really starting to get to a more very Lovecrafty kind of stuff there.
Yeah. They've gotten permission to explore the ruins from the Arab government of the province.
Right.
So they're all there officially.
And they're ready to go. The professor's been holding onto this envelope that he produces in this moment. He's had it for 25 years. He thinks that what's in this envelope is going to help him find the treasure in Meroe. So at this point, he shares it with everybody. Pulling this letter out of the envelope, it says, "To the student who, having counted the cost, is resolute to once more reveal to the skeptical the ancient glory of Hori Meroe." Yes. So basically what this letter says, 4 days' journey from Meroe toward Arabia is a city founded by men from the Upper Nile. And this city is filled with crazy treasure, but it's hidden. When Egypt rose to power, this early Ethiopian civilization cut itself off from the rest of the world because they didn't want Pharaoh getting up in their business.
Yeah.
However, this document shows a way to get to this hidden city. It's the way that the priests go in and out. It's good stuff. It's got lots of Indiana Jones type things in it. Like the entrance lies under the head of a sphinx. There's a sacred crocodile still living. All those centuries have rolled by and men have gathered to the shades who once tended on its wants. Loved that. That's the monster that's out there in the jungle.
Super
and
cool.
Beware the fifth gallery to the right where abide the sacred serpents with jeweled crowns, for of a truth, they are terrible.
Charlie, he laughs off the whole thing because he just thinks it's all, you know, myth and BS. But the professor goes into telling the story of ancient Ethiopia.
Yes, he's giving more of this background about the ancient civilizations. And basically the gist of it, he says right here, "For 3,000 years, the world has been mainly indebted for its advancement to the Romans, Greeks, Hebrews, Germans, and Anglo-Saxons. But it was otherwise in the first years. Babylon and Egypt, Nimrod and Mizraim, both descendants of Ham, led the way and acted as the pioneers of mankind in the untrodden fields of knowledge." So again, that idea that all the architects of Western and white society stood on the shoulders of more ancient black societies from Africa. Mm-hmm. We're all contributing to the advancement of the human race. And of course, that freaks Charlie out. He says, "Great Scott, you don't mean to tell me this was all done by n-t." Yes, that is what the professor is saying, Charlie.
Get over it.
After all of this lengthy explanation, which we can just kind of, I don't want to get too in-depth on it because we want to move the story forward here, but a listener is unnamed, says, "It is hard to believe your story. From what a height must this people have fallen to reach the abjectness of the American Negro?" "True," replied the professor, "but from what a depth does history show that the Anglo-Saxon has climbed to the position of the first people of the earth today?" Everybody was debased at some point. It's all a big continuum of people ascending and descending, apparently.
Yep.
And then he reveals that he received this document that he's holding from a camel driver who knew all these ancient languages and was actually a native of that hidden city. Camel driver was dying and he passed this on to him. And that camel driver also knew of a prophecy. He said, "A king of an ancient line, an offspring of that Ergamenes who lived in the reign of the second Ptolemy, will return and restore the former glory of the race. The preservation of this hidden city is for his reception." So this king's going to come back.
Yep.
Take command in the hidden city. It's that chosen one trope.
Yep.
Which is, exists in Star Wars and exists in a ton of different things, but it's here as well.
King Ergamenes was also known as King Archimani, and he reigned from 295 to 275 BC, and he was the first great king of Meroe. He broke free from the Egyptian dominance to help direct his wholly different culture.
And he was a real guy.
He was a real guy, yeah.
Well, we wonder, how will we know who this chosen one is when he shows up?
Right.
The man says, "I asked the camel driver this question, and he said that every descendant of the royal line bears a lotus lily in the form of a birthmark upon his breast."
Right.
When Raoul hears this, he goes, "Oh!" Charlie looks at him like, that was an odd reaction.
I wonder what that could mean.
In that movie that we made, The Chosen One, then he's got the mark that shows that he's the prophesied ruler.
Well, obviously, we're kind of making fun of the whole trope because it is overused trope, and we're kind of taking a poke at it.
But it is being used to great effect in this book. Yeah. They all hit the hay after this long discussion, and then we get into chapter 8 where they arrive at the ruins and pyramids of Meroe.
Yeah, you can find lots of pictures of this place online. It's pretty cool. The ruins are still there, and people could go visit them, obviously.
There are quite a few passages talking about the glory of the architecture, the writing, the art. Concludes saying, "Now, however, Meroe's schools are closed forever, not a vestige is remaining of the houses of her philosophers, not a stone rests upon another, and where civilization and learning once reigned, ignorance and barbarism have reassumed their sway." And then there's a real note of editorial anger here, I thought, where it says, "This is the people whose posterity has been denied a rank among the human race and has been degraded into a species of talking baboons." Not something a character said. That's the writer.
Yeah.
For the first time, I thought in here, really angrily bemoaning the state of things, you know?
Justifiably.
Pretty effective passage. The excavation is going well. They're finding all sorts of artifacts. Raoul is pretty down in the dumps, still anxious about news from home. But this chapter concludes with news from home. The mail has arrived.
Yay!
So it must be good news, right?
It was some 3 weeks after this before Briggs was able to assume his duties. The sudden shock of the news of his wife's death overweighted a brain already strained to the utmost.
Oh, man.
Oh, no.
So I guess that when that boat overturned, everybody did die. At least that's what he thinks.
At this, Raoul has suffered this prolonged grieving process for weeks. He's useless to anyone. He's just sleeping all day, not unlike a teenager.
And one day while he's in this grieving stupor, he hears the others say, "Oh, we found the Sphinx head." Which was described in the manuscript that the professor has, but they can't move it, so they're just going to give up, which I thought was really weak.
I know.
He's been hanging on to this thing for 25 years. He finally finds it, and he goes, it's too hard.
Yeah, we can't do this.
Well, Raoul, one night, he gets up with his gun, and he leaves a note for Charlie that he's going to go check out this third pyramid where that Sphinx head is all alone. Don't worry. Because he's thinking, I ain't worried about no snakes or crocodiles eating up on me.
Yeah.
My life is over. My wife's dead. So he takes a boat in the middle of the night and rows over to Meroe. He gets there. The whole scene's super spooky and unnerving, so much so that it actually helps him get back some of his will to live, just pure fear for his own self-preservation. He can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want to die. He finds the Sphinx. He goes to examine it, and then he gets chloroformed by somebody, basically.
Yeah.
Somebody sneaks up and puts a rag over his mouth, and he passes out. Yeah. And do you remember... That chloroformed urban legend that was...
Yes.
There were two roommates.
Yeah, there were two roommates. And then the guy, he's a new college student. He moves in with this dude. He keeps... His anus is hurting him.
Right.
And I heard he had bleeding in his anus.
Yes.
And he doesn't know what the problem is. So he goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, you know, you've been having anal sex. And he's like, no, I haven't. He goes, well, it sure looks like you have. The punchline of the urban myth is that he's in bed sleeping, and then he wakes up to his roommate sneaking into his room with some chloroform
and having his way with him.
I totally believed that when I was 18 years old at college, because that's the, you know, that's when you hear these things. I checked it out on Snopes, man. This is an old urban myth. It was first documented in 1886.
Right.
There was a book called The Book of a Thousand Nights and a Night. It was also in a dirty joke book.
Okay.
But it was typically a military thing is where it kind of first came out of. So when people were in the military, there'd be military barracks or campus dormitories.
Okay.
And then that's where it would happen. And then it would usually end with some kind of revenge being done on the perpetrator. So they would, you know, go beat him up, or they would do some horrible thing out to the guy or whatever.
The thing is still running because I went online and just did a quick roommate chloroform thing, and a million things popped up. And there was one from 2011 where a girl was, you know, it was like a message board. A friend of my brother's told me this. So crazy. And it had the revenge in it too. So he went to bed that night with a baseball bat, and then he saw the guy sneaking over, and then he beat the shit out of him,
yep,
you know?
Yep.
So it's still going strong, but it was great. This girl told that story completely. This happened to a friend of my brother's, and then all the comments after it, oh my God, if that dude did that to me, I would have done this. And, you know, people are still talking about it.
Back to the story. Raoul wakes up. He realizes that there's all these men around him, and he's on this couch. These men are all varied in complexion. Some are white, some are black, some are in between. And they're all good looking guys, and they're kind of dressed in a strange way. And they speak ancient Arabic.
And the leader of them sees that Raoul is awake and says, all you guys get out of here. I want to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that Raoul understands. He talks about, oh, this leader isn't quite 40, but he's got this amazing presence. It says it's a weird thing, but Raoul can understand and speak with him. He says, how crazy would it be if I were back home and people heard me jumping into this ancient Arabic like this?
Right, yeah.
And again, we've got this ancient advanced necropolis trope. It's this hidden city that's discovered. It fits in with the Chosen One trope quite well.
Yeah.
And this, of course, reminded me of Wakanda from Marvel Comics.
Yeah. I was totally thinking
the Black Panther deals. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, Wakanda's awesome too. And I think it's cool that Marvel wrote this, because like Wakanda is the most evolved country technologically and philosophically in the world. And it's set in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Like Wakanda is 10,000 years old in the Marvel. Right. You know, that the country has been around for 10,000 years. No country has been around for 10,000 years. It just doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's well advanced over everybody. They say that the city is called Telesar.
Telesar. Yeah. This city, yes, this hidden city. The leader says, you're not in Wakanda. This is the hidden city, Telesar. He doesn't say you're not in Wakanda.
No.
But in my people, you will behold the direct descendants of the inhabitants of Merowe. We are waiting for the coming of our king who shall restore the Ethiopian race to its ancient glory. He says, I am AI is his name, his faithful prime minister.
And Telesar is from the Bible. It's a mythic city that was inhabited by the children of Eden.
They talk about that a little bit in here.
Yeah.
Ruhl is pretty confused by what the leader is telling him, but the basics of it are that Ethiopia got all arrogant and prideful because they were so advanced that they fell from glory. There's been a long line of caretakers from 6,000 years before Christ until now. That figure keeps coming up. That 6,000 years before Christ, this civilization was happening. They've been keeping things tight in the city for when the prophecy king shows up. So that's kind of been their job. He says, we'll talk more later. I want you to get some rest. He takes Raoul into this sick apartment, which makes all the stuff from the modern world just look like a Motel 6. That goes on and on about how great the silken cushions of the couch are and etc. I mean, they probably got bling water in there, I assume.
Yeah, dude. They sprinkle diamonds on your food so that your poo glitters.
I stayed at a night at Trump Tower in Chicago, and they had bling water.
What's bling water?
It was a $55 bottle of water.
Oh my God.
It had like diamond encrusted Trump on the front of it.
What?
Yeah, it's just water. I went down the rabbit hole with that when I was thinking about it. And of course, they've tested this bling water all over the place, and people can't tell it from tap water.
Of course.
At all. Chapter 15 here, he wakes up. Raoul does. His clothes have been replaced by the native stuff. So he's in the native garb now. They step outside of this dwelling, and Raoul gets a look at this place he's been staying in.
Yeah.
It's this amazing palace. It's amazing stuff as far as the eye can see here. Lots of Milton quoting going on. You can only think of poetry from Milton to express how beautiful this land is.
He also tells them that they are technologically advanced, way more than the outside world. And then Raoul says, well, how do you know so much about the outside world? And I says, well, we send people out. Your camel driver, a Baptist, is actually from here, and he's just keeping tabs on the outside world, you know, to keep it hidden and keep us informed about what's going on.
They send camel drivers out to find out what's happening in the world.
They go out on this balcony and all these people are out there and they're looking up and they start chanting, "Hail Ergamenes! Hail Ergamenes!" Because Raoul is occasionally conveniently stupid, he asks, "Who's this Ergamenes?" Eyes like, "Baby, it's you."
That's right.
What?
He's the chosen one.
This is a lot for Raoul to take in, so Ai takes him inside and they talk for a bit and says, "You're the son of a fallen dynasty, outcast of a sunken people. Upon your breast is the lotus lily, God's mark to prove your race and descent. You are him and you will restore Ethiopia." They go into some of the religion and the background of this place. They have a group of singers and musicians that come in and tell this really long story about the history of the people, which is kind of already covered. I don't know why they need to go into more detail about Meroe and how it was once powerful in the center of the ancient world, but it soon became corrupted. All this craziness starts making sense to Raoul. He knew that he was part Ethiopian, but he hid that fact from the world. I guess lots of black kids at the time were told that they were children of kings from Africa. So that was something that he thought was just a tale that his mother told him.
But it's not. He's the king. He's come back to his ancient city. In the next chapter, Ai says, "Well, tell me about where you come from. Tell me about America."
Well, he says, "Is it true that the Ethiopian there is counted less than other mortals?" He says, "Yeah, it's deep disgrace to have within the veins even one drop of blood." Again, you know, I can't get over how crazy that stuff is.
Yeah.
That people really believe this stuff. I guess more importantly, that people still believe this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Segregation didn't end in the United States until 1964. That's not that long ago.
No.
Which is pretty crazy.
And I think it's crazy as well as he's hearing about this. He's saying, look, all of Western culture came out of Ethiopia. How is it possible for us to have fallen so far?
He goes into some detail about how they're structured, and there's a female monarch and there's a council and there's some sages, and it's a lot of detail about this culture that really doesn't have much bearing on the story itself. It's just kind of interesting.
No, but this is stuff that Lovecraft would have loved. You know, there's an inner city that's, you know, it's only virgins that live there, and that's how the queen chooses her successor every 15 years.
Yep.
It's always Queen Candace. It talks about how you become a sage and blah, blah, blah. Lots of details.
There's some weird stuff too, where they say they've got this weird powdery stuff that preserves bodies perfectly at death, and then they have this place to show off the most beautiful dead people.
Yeah, that was creepy.
I was like, whoa, that's out of nowhere. But really cool, and kind of makes it a little bit more alien and interesting. They also have one god, which is a little bit more Eastern, kind of metaphysically speaking, and they call it Ego.
Mm-hmm.
Ego came off of God, the god, and sort of became part person. So he like lives within people. He is constantly trying to overcome his desire to be part of the real living world and being part of people, so he could reunite with his whole self, so he can become the creator once again. So that there is some kind of reincarnation is part of the natural laws of Earth. Of course, the ego can never be destroyed. Raoul is like, well, what about Jesus? And I says, oh yeah, we've heard of him, but we never really gave much thought. And Raoul is like, dude, Jesus is real and he is the way. Then I is like, oh, okay, great. We'll now change tens of thousands of years of tradition and belief because you just said so. All right, all done. I'll let everybody know. It's like, what?
Well, he's the king.
Oh.
I know, it's weird.
I know he's the king, but you would go, well, maybe you should think a little bit more about our religion. You know, well, just me telling you a paragraph worth of stuff. Yeah, you know, maybe we should talk about this. Have a conversation.
It says, oh, Ergamenes, your belief shall be ours. We have no will but yours. So if Ergamenes is into it, he's got the mark on his chest. He knows.
Yeah, that's it. So they love Jesus.
He brought Jesus to this ancient city. And hopefully we brought a little Jesus into your lives today. We're running out of time, man.
We're running a little long, but I just find this really fascinating, and I've been really enjoying the story and our coverage of it. So hopefully you have too.
Well, folks, what's going to happen now? We've got the Lost City. We've discovered the history, what's really going on in Rule's background. In this last show that we're going to do next week, all the pieces tumble together. We find out what happens back in good old America, how all these characters are interrelated, and what the horrific conclusion will be to their story.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
We will talk about that next time. I want to thank KJ Middlebrooks for reading for us once again.
Thank you so much, KJ. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.